Planning and Development Real Estate Committee will reconvene. I move that the board certify to the best of each member's knowledge, and with no individual member dissenting, that at the just concluded executive session, only such matters as authorized for discussion in executive session under Board Procedure 6, and only those matters identified in the motion by which the executive session was convened and were discussed or considered by the board. Second by Mr. Benjamin. Discussion. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Okay. We are back in reconvening, and we don't have five members here.
Mr. Graham.
We let everybody know we're ready.
I think you need to do your motion over again.
It's a Clinton. Who wasn't here?
Okay.
Yeah, but we really.
We can say that we have served cleansed.
Yeah, now we're okay. Roberts.
Yep.
We can record all of those members present upstairs as voting yes? Okay. That means we're clean. All right. The next item is the approval of the agenda. Okay, if there are no objections.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
On behalf of the District of Columbia, we would like to postpone item 9A on the headquarters relocation until January meeting. I make this request on behalf of the mayor, Mr. Albert, have indicated to me that they're not ready to go forward today.
Correct.
I'm glad you said correct, because if you had said that's not correct, I would have. I rushed over here. I didn't even make the cup of tea.
I'm sorry. You were having a conversation with Mr. Albert, but I guess I need a clarity.
I move to postpone item 9A until January.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there a discussion?
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Yule.
Any chance of, why January, why not December?
Madam Chair, if I may speak. So WMATA did a very extensive analysis that was presented to this body, I think a couple of months ago, and the district wants to do a thorough job of not just analyzing what was presented by WMATA, but also positioning the district to make what we consider a response that will be good for all jurisdictions, and it does take some time to do so.
Okay. The item has come as an information item, I think, repeatedly, and it has been asked to be deferred repeatedly. I think if we are going to defer it, can we bring it back to staff as an action item? And that way the presentation can be made, and then we can decide. I would assume through the deferral you will have the clarity as to whether or not we can move forward on this, and therefore I think we can be explicit about that by making it as an action item.
In January, I would accept that as a modification.
All right, any other questions? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Yes, opposed? I think I left something off. Yes, the agenda. The agenda should reflect the removal of the joint development small local minority business enterprise policy guidelines as not part of this agenda being removed. Is there consensus on that?
And we can be explicit, they're being deferred.
They're being deferred, yes.
Expect them next month.
Any consensus? All right. All right, the next item is the approval of the minutes on the 25th of September 2008.
Will they be accepted as presented?
Is there a second?
Second.
Question?
I do have some changes, as usual.
We do all the time. We appreciate that.
On page 3. At the bottom, I presume that the rights that are referred to are RIGHTS, not R-I-T-E-S, different kind of rights.
Oh.
Well, we read it, but...
No, that's a ceremony we prefer.
So if we could correct that and change the type of rights. But more important, on page 42B, second line, I'd like to insert so that it reads...
Where are we?
Which page?
I'm sorry, 4 of 42. I'm sorry, 4 of 42. B, we're looking at the capital inventory. Second line, I'd like it to read, will serve as the foundation for a prioritization of...
I'm sorry, I don't see it. Would you go back to where you are?
Okay, I'm on...
Okay, under the capital.
Page 4 of 43.
Oh, first paragraph, okay.
It's under B, second line, the paragraph starts with staff presented a comprehensive, and have it on the second line read, will serve as the foundation for a prioritization of.
I think that was our...
Emphasizing the fact that that's what we were trying to do.
Okay, we're not editing for the sake of editing, we're editing to get
right.
The point that was brought in, and
right.
you raised, and we all raised, priority.
Prioritization. Okay. Without those changes, I'm comfortable.
All right. Any others? All those, any objection to the changes? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. The next is the October 16th minutes.
Chairman, I move they be accepted as presented or with any changes that Mr. Benjamin may have.
There you go.
I do have one.
Is there a second?
Second.
Mr. Benjamin, your amendments.
On the last page, the last item, approval priority corridor network report and implementation, I believe that it was an action item. I do believe that we acted on it. There's nothing shown as an action. And if I remember correctly, the action was that we approved it for planning purposes only, not for implementation, being very careful to make that distinction. I think it's very important that if we do an action, that it be so recorded.
Is there acceptance of that amendment as the motion stated?
I guess that's the question is, that's correct.
That is correct.
That is correct, yeah.
Is there an item coming to us at the board meeting then today?
We're coming back in January.
That's what I thought. So when you say action, what we're saying here is not that it was a board action, but that it was direction given by.
I thought that we were asked for a vote, and we voted to approve it for planning purposes.
Correct.
Yes. And so, but that doesn't need to go to the board then?
Oh, yes, it is going.
I'm sorry, I thought it went to the board.
I think it did go to the board and it was approved for planning purposes.
For planning purposes.
And if this was the October 16th meeting, then it would be going today to the board. It would be on the agenda.
Did we do it on the 16th?
October board meeting, I believe.
I thought it went to the same board meeting the same day.
Right
to the board meeting.
And the board has, in fact, acted on it.
Yes. And we acted.
And Mr. Benjamin is obviously correct. Yes, and exceptions.
It would be nice if the minutes would show the actions that we take.
But the item in January is scheduled to respond to some to additional direction that we were given.
All righty. Thank you very much. The next item is the amendment to the joint development and guideline selection criteria. And the action from executive section. Is there a motion? This is the criteria.
Yeah, but we passed those by.
No, we passed by the SLIM, not passed by first. And we need a motion.
I move the approval of the resolution and the attachment with a couple of changes. First of all, the second resolved, which gives the general manager the authority to modify the attachment, the self-certification be deleted. Yeah, I don't know what page it's on in the packet. This is the resolution for joint development guidelines to establish selection criteria.
Just above page 11 of our agenda, and it is the second from the last resolution.
Right. Just delete that resolved.
Right.
And the other change would be to insert, if you go to page 14, paragraph two from the bottom that starts, an offeror is unable to certify. This is in the self-certification. The second sentence, the first sentence is actually in the guidelines in two different places. In those same two places, also insert either that sentence, the second sentence, or the equivalent of that sentence into the guidelines themselves. With those changes, I move this resolution.
Second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. And the next item is the shared use parking at the Marriott WMATA's parking garage in Prince George's County Plaza, American Metro Rail. Mr. Bodenheimer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're coming to you today asking for authorization to negotiate and execute an amendment to the Joint Development Agreement ground lease in Prince George's Plaza Station Retail LLC to allow Marriott Courtyard to have non-exclusive use of 45 spaces in our parking garage at Prince George's Plaza. The joint development project is a mixed-use project that includes housing, retail, and office space. The proposed fourth element to this, a hotel, is a 162-room hotel to be about 250 feet from the station. And the space is backup parking capacity. The hotel already has adequate parking in the existing retail parking at the station, and these spaces would be for additional capacity in the event that there's a special event that requires sort of peak capacity. It's not for guests. It's not for employees. Just to go over existing conditions here, this is the Prince George's Plaza station as it was in 2003. This is East-West Highway. Prince George College Park is up this way, and West Hyattsville is about a half a mile, three-quarters of a mile down this way. The hotel is to be located in this portion of the site. Our parking garage is here. It's got over 1,000 parking spaces, currently operating at about 51% occupancy. Current use regulations permit incidental use of garages, and that incidental use is to be in non-peak or non-revenue hours. Or it must be approved by the board, because the agreement that we're proposing with the hotel would include peak hour usage, or would likely include peak hour usage. We definitely need board approval. And the agreement, specifics of the agreement, we've negotiated with Marriott to pay us a daily rate of $6.40, which is 1.5 times the daily rate there, for not more than 45 spaces. Marriott customers would have unlimited entry and exit during the course of the day. The spaces would be non-exclusive. They would not be reserved. It would be first come, first served. So if the garage is full, and there wouldn't be a space available for them. Marriott will be paying for the installation of technology to allow for the tracking of the in and outs, and we've been assured that we'll be able to read that and know the difference between a Metro customer and a Marriott customer. The initial agreement is for 5 years, with the option for 5 yearly renewals after that, cancelable at any time annually by either party. There's a nexus between the hotel guest use and the transit users coming out of our 2005 development-related ridership survey, which found that for all hotels surveyed, irrespective of distance, that means hotels right on our system and up to a half mile away, 27% of hotel trips were via transit. The 45 spaces requested are about 28% of hotel capacity, so there is a nexus there. And whether the people who are using these parking spaces are actually transit users, or whether the provision of this parking is making it possible for a hotel to be there and thus for other users of the hotel to be transit users, there's a relationship between the number of spaces and our ridership findings. Benefits are supporting transit-oriented development. We're reducing the need for construction of additional parking. I guess one point I would make about this is that this has been identified as not crucial for the hotel to develop. They do have adequate space right now. This is really to make the strongest, this is helping them make the strongest possible case to lenders that they have adequate parking for their patrons. But they have been clear that this is not absolutely critical. This does allow us to take advantage of surplus capacity and would increase parking revenue. Again, this is the location of the proposed hotel. This is East-West Highway along here. And the recommendation is that staff be authorized to negotiate and execute an amendment with Prince George's Station Retail LLC for these parking spaces. That concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Mrs. Bodenheimer. We're talking about excess unused space that's occurring now in the garage.
That's correct. It's 51% used.
Any questions from
us? Yes. Well, yes. One relevant fact, which is that we have also arranged with the hotel that if at any point our parking capacity exceeds 92.5%, the agreement would be terminable. So if 1 year from now all of a sudden there's a spike in parking demand for Metro patrons, then the agreement is voided.
Mr. Benjamin has a question.
Okay.
First of all, let me comment that this is a transit-oriented development of the type that I think is really excellent. I think that Marriott building here is a great idea, and I strongly support that. I strongly support the hotel. And my vision of what would happen there is that people would come from North Carolina or West Virginia or Massachusetts, drive to the hotel, park, and then ride Metro. You know, that's the perfect tourist location for this kind of situation. Unfortunately, the way this is proposed, it feels exactly like the Nuclear Regulatory Commission proposal that never got approved by the board, and that is it's destination parking. It is saying we want to be able to get in and out as often as we want, which implies that you're not really parking, leaving your car and riding Metro, you're parking and then driving. If this proposal were at one time the daily rate instead of 1.5 times the daily rate, and with one time in and one time out per day, just like everybody else, I would strongly support it. As destination parking, I feel I have to vote against it, even though I strongly support the overall project. And noting the fact that there's plenty of other parking there, I don't see why the Metro parking needs to be destination parking.
No questions? Yes.
Staff getting any pushback from the developer or the Marriott Hotel to accept what Mr. Benjamin just said in terms of the in and out?
The hotel said, has advised us if we limited it to one time in, one time out, that they would just drop the deal.
They wouldn't drop building the hotel.
No, correct. That's correct. They would build the hotel.
Chair?
Yes.
That suggests that we really don't need to do this. I had a number of questions, one being how many parking spaces is the hotel being constructed with?
I'm going to ask staff for assistance with that. It's 2 Prince George's County Code. Frost Doggett?
I don't guess I'm not going to have an answer to the question.
Right.
Of course it's being built through Prince George's County Code. The question is how many parking spaces are there already? And why would they need more? And if they need these more, and we give them to them for a while, and then we take them back when we need them, what will they be doing then? And if they're building a brand new hotel 250 feet from a Metro station, goes back to Benjamin's point, why aren't we trying to orient them to the use of Metro? Why would we be using our garage built for transit purposes for something that's really not a transit purpose? I agree with Mr. Benjamin. It's the kind of development we want to encourage overall. A hotel located there is a good thing, and I think that's fine, and we want to be as helpful as we can be reasonably. But this looks like something that we don't need to do. The development doesn't depend upon it. It's counter to what our approach and policy is, and if we were to do it, it's not clear that you could easily get out of it. Or if you did so, that you'd be creating a problem, and we'd have people here in the future saying, well, gee, you know, it would really be, you know, a problem to take these things away. I just don't understand this. I'm uncomfortable with making kind of parking arrangement, period. I wouldn't be nearly as enthusiastic about it on the terms that Mr. Benjamin said he could enthusiastically support it. But I could see going along with it for that. I still think there's the question about, should you be doing this, and if you do, how do you get out of it? But the 1.5 times the daily rate for unlimited in and out, it's a way of saying this is no longer a transit structure, even though it was built with public funds for that purpose. It's a subsidy to a hotelier who apparently doesn't need the subsidy.
Mr. Question about getting out of this. What are the options?
The options is a five-year agreement, the first 5 years, with us being able to get out if we demand ever exceeds 92.5% of the capacity. It's at 51% right now.
That's a question.
Thank you. That was one of my questions. Unlike my colleagues, I can support this. I do think it supports transit-oriented development, as my colleagues have indicated as well. But I don't see where it hurts WMATA at all. I think I see where there's a benefit to WMATA, and I don't. We're talking about excess capacity, and I don't see it. It seems like it's a win-win. And I think that you have already explained that there's a way to get it. You know, there'll always be some provisions in a contract about how you extricate yourself.
I know.
And I'm sure there'll always be some sort of catch-all phrase as well. But also, if it gets to the 92.5%. So I just think this is fundamentally a good policy in this instance. And we already have... in our current regulations, it says you have to bring it to the board if it involves non-peak hours on a case-by-case basis. And I think this is one of those instances where it is appropriate, particularly in Prince George's County, where we've been struggling desperately for transit-oriented development. I just think I would wholeheartedly support it.
Any other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Albert.
Okay. So I join my colleague from Prince George's County, and I'm actually going to support this. I do see this as transitory end of development. As the WMATA staff presented, this is a site that's underutilized. I think you suggested it is about 50 to 52% occupancy. It provides a source of revenue, a new source of revenue for WMATA. I've been on this board for less than a month, and in all the conversations we've had have been around how we present new sources of revenue to the metro system, and I think this provides an opportunity. But more importantly, as a development potential for Prince George's County, I think this body needs to respect that. The fact that it's only 45 spaces, I think, still leaves a lot of capacity for core transit-oriented development and transit-oriented uses, and so I do believe it serves the purposes and the guidelines for use of WMATA properties, but also supports development prospects in Prince George's County.
Thank you. Any other questions? I just have one comment, and I'm going to support it, and I am supporting it because I kind of empathize with what may be happening there, and that is that many hotelers, as they go further out, get very skittish about whether or not they have the capacity to address the parking needs, and we are encouraging them to use the transit system. I think we have the best of both worlds there. We have the transit available, and we have the garage there that is underutilized. I would like for us to think about negotiating the time down to a less than the five-year agreement. We have the option of the 92% that would drive it back to WMATA's taking that back, and they have to rely upon their own parking. But it's just really is to me showing a revenue source that I don't think hurts us, and I think it probably in the end will be to our betterment rather than serving the hotel any better, because people will convert. I have a little bit more confidence in the fact of what has occurred in the more purely transit development areas, that you have reduced your vehicle usage because the transit is there and people recognize it. But I think as you go further out, it's a harder piece to do that. I see it happening where I am, and it will. I'll just finish. I think WMATA will not be hurt by it. We still have our mission of making sure that people are brought to the transit as an alternative mode of transportation. Both of them sit at the location. Mr. Zimmerman, you want to?
I hear what you're saying, but these people have decided to do this development. They're going to build it. And if you had this situation, for instance, in your jurisdiction, and they were coming there, and they were skittish about this, as you said, you would have heard that in the front end, and you would have worked something out for parking, which maybe would have said we'd try to get some parking in Metro, but you didn't know that beforehand. These guys have already decided they're building this thing.
That is exactly right.
And you know, you did say you'd like to negotiate down to something. What we're being asked today is give them direction to negotiate, which, by the way, I don't know why we're doing that in public. We've now tipped our hand on the whole thing. But it seems to me, at the very least, we should be directing them to negotiate to a one-time daily rate, not to a one-and-a-half-time daily rate. We're giving up the fight before we do it. What's to negotiate? You're handing it away. And that's what this says. This says, you know, we should authorize the staff to negotiate and execute an amendment. You know, and here it is, we've now publicly discussed whether we'll give them something that you already know they don't need.
Well,
Madam Chair.
Benjamin. Oh, did you have a question?
Yes.
We have two questions on the floor. Yes, Mr. Benjamin and Mr. Albert.
Again, I'm very supportive of transit-oriented development. I'm relieved that in this particular case, we will not be questioning whether the transit-oriented development will occur. And so I'm really looking at the issue of, should we be a source of destination parking, and is our revenue need so high that that's what we're going to do? We are, after all, a transit agency, and I think that principle is important. This is the second time this issue has come up within a year, and it seems to me that it might be very helpful if staff would put together a proposal for a policy relative to these kinds of issues so that we don't go through this discussion again and again and again. And maybe what we can do is develop and approve a policy for this so that staff has guidance as to what to do in this kind of situation.
Okay. Mr. Albertson?
I was just going to ask that, if there was a policy that guided these kinds of transactions, and Mr. Benjamin.
I think the policy is in this situation, you come back to the board and ask them.
That's exactly what we've done. Okay, all those in.
Other question?
Yes.
What is the process for unwinding this? What do you imagine would actually happen?
Well, at this point, we would not be able to unwind it during the first 5 years unless...
No, I'm sorry. When the term expired, what actually happened?
At the end of 5 years.
Yeah. Who's had the option to renew?
It is cancelable by either party. So if we say at the end of 5 years, we don't want to...
I'm sorry. Do I have to move to cancel the thing at the end of 5 years, or does it expire unless there's an affirmative action to renew it?
I'm going to ask for staff's help with that.
I think it said it was canceled.
There would have to be an affirmative action to renew.
Correct.
Yes.
It would otherwise expire.
Yes.
Madam Chairman, we don't actually have a motion. Do we?
You haven't gotten the motion on the floor yet.
Well, I'd like to ask that it not be 5 years, because again, this is so important.
Would you like to set up?
How does it go away? What happens at the end of the time when you take away parking that they're now used to having? And so, I don't understand how that works at all, but if we're going to have some kind of rationale that they needed at the beginning, they don't need it for 5 years. Again, how do you have a hotel coming in that doesn't have enough parking, and you're going to give them temporary parking that they're not going to have it?
But they would have to come back. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I'm not going to.
Sorry, Madam Chair. But you've already heard that they would have to come back and to renew the contract expires on its own at the end of the 5 years.
And we'll have the same discussion.
And they would have to come back. Well, I mean, the term doesn't have to be. I mean, you can renegotiate at that point.
My question here is, if they need it now, why wouldn't they need it in 5 years?
Because the same, Mr. Zimmerman, because the same reason they don't use it where you sit today, because they don't have a need for it. They feel fully satisfied with their customer base that they use a transit service. I guess I find myself in these discussions with trying to share parking repeatedly. In an ideal situation, it works fine. I advocate for it. But there are situations in which you do find yourself in that negotiation of trying to figure out, under the leasing agreement of a hotel, do they feel comfortable with the capacity of parking that they have? I would wager that they're going to feel more than comfortable, because they're going to look at their bottom line and see that they're spending funds for parking and they really don't need it. But that's not for me to figure out. That's for them to figure out.
I have one more question.
Yes.
Mr. Bodenheimer, did you indicate that this is something that they need at this point in time to help get their transit or that this hotel going.
It strengthens the case of going to lenders.
Lenders, that's what I wanted to make sure.
And the aspect of the unlimited in and out is a question of customer service. I mean, I'm representing the comments that have been made to us. Is what they feel that they've been made aware that another option for them would be to have a smart card and just to use it on the same basis that a transit patron does. It is one in, one out. And they've said that does not provide the kind of customer service that they want to provide, but they know that it's an option. But so the two points are strengthening the casing to going to the case for going to the lending community and in and out for providing customer service level.
Which means
that
they will not be similarly situated 5 years from now.
They would not be similarly situated because they would already have had the financing.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Do we know what they're going to be charging for parking if you're a patron at their hotel?
They're not charging for parking?
We don't know.
I don't know that the answer to that question, but I think that we don't have any indication that they're charging.
I think you would want to at least have some proviso in here that relates to any future change in their parking policy, because wouldn't it be embarrassing if it turned out the people going there were paying, I don't know, 10, 15 bucks to park, as you will in hotels all over the place, and that they're using parking that they get for us at this tiny little rate they're paying, because that's like nothing, and using the space, you know, multiple times and all that, and making money off the thing. Or even if they're not off that one somehow, the fact that they're charging parking, you know, they're going to have a parking policy for their own, but the own parking that they provide, if they wind up, you know, charging something more, it's going to look pretty bad. So,
to be specific,
you know, make sure they're not making a windfall off our parking.
To be specific on that, would you say something like $6.40 or a percentage of the charge, the amount charged to the customer, whichever is greater? And it could be 100%, it could be 80%.
I would say that you should charge them every time they go in and out of our garage like anyone else does. But if someone's going to look to protect themselves,
Your proposal would be $6.40 per day or the amount charged by the hotel to the customer, mm-hmm. whichever is greater. So that they do not make any money on. I'm asking the question.
I think your concept
like
is
the
what
right direction.
Yes. Yeah, he's giving you a concept that he'd like to see, and I think that's what he's asking. Mr. Benjamin.
Let me just check. When you said $6.40, that isn't really what you're negotiating. You're negotiating 1.5 times the going rate. Right?
That's correct. Okay. It is right. So it'd be 1.5 times, but to be clear.
Okay, so the motion is there a motion on the floor?
I'm going to move recommendation as presented.
As presented, second.
Just to make clear, Madam Chairman, what we're proposing here is not that they're paying 1.5 times for the space. They're paying 1.5 times the rate you would pay each time you went in and out and getting the entire day and getting to move as many cars in and out as they want to for that space. Just so everybody understands that that's what you're doing.
That is
it. Well, it's not as many cars. I understand why you're saying that, but it's unlimited in and out for the holder of that card, and potentially they could turn it in and somebody else could use the same car. But
that's what they'll do. They'll valet the thing. That's what they're going to do.
But that is what we're presenting.
And the only reason that isn't a revenue issue is because you have excess capacity. Because if you had a full garage at any point here, you would be losing money on this. Instead of having cars coming in and out paying each time, you don't want to sell.
I am not favorable. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's a good question, which was on my mind. Is should our capacity become full? You know, that should be a cancellation.
They have a percentage.
Yes.
Of that.
Yes. If it becomes 92.5% full, then we would it would be cancelable at that point.
And how many spaces would 92 and I see? How many spaces would 92.5?
0.9 times 1068, so it's about 950.
The motion that's on the table does not include any of the considerations that were discussed here, and I'm going to leave it because I think staff has heard one of the concepts that would be part of negotiating that.
I may have just missed that one, but I guess I did have. Can I ask a question?
Yes, you may. Go ahead.
The thing that did concern me that I just heard was the valet issue. And is that something that is there a way to address that?
Again, let me ask staff for help on that.
Car into
Rush.
The 45 cars are Lewis cars for
I mean, I guess I don't want to make sure it's not like okay, they don't have a way of saying, okay, there's just one pass and everybody and the grandmother can park there.
I think we can work out an arrangement with economic service.
I would hope so.
Okay.
With the directions of that as part of your motion, that we would make sure that the agreement reflected that. Did you have another?
I suggest the motion be amended to eliminate the execute portion, and that would negotiate and bring back for approval by the board.
Seconder? Who seconded it? If not, it's amendment.
I think I
accepted to do that.
No, you like it. Sorry? Amount of time? Do we have a deadline? Was is that inconsistent? Okay, so the question is, if we are given the authority to negotiate, it's okay, we can bring it back for execution by approval and execution by the board without coming a cropper with one of the deadlines for the hotel. Okay, that's there's not a timing issue there.
Okay, so it's to return to the board after the negotiation. All those in favor of the motion's on the table. Anybody in favor of the motion? Okay. The motion that substitutes the limitations as to the use of the space and to bring back the item after negotiation for execution. Mm-hmm. But it's returning to the board. Yes.
You're not taking the motion on amendment or motion on the motion?
Well, I didn't take your amendment. I assume that it was okay to roll it into the motion. But if you'd like to take your amendment first, we can do that. Yeah. Well, the main motion simply talks about the negotiation. There was the item as to the limitation of the use of the spaces, and with the negotiations to limit the use of the spaces and to return to the board before executing.
And were those incorporated by unanimous consent to the main motion?
That was the question that was raised, that we had not voted on it, and the seconder accepted. The maker made them. Okay.
Okay, so we don't have an amendment to vote on.
We have a motion, yeah. And this item has been expanded to two things. Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay. We have Mr. Benjamin and Mr. Zimmerman voting.
Three.
I'm sorry, Mr. Yule. The motion passed.
So okay. What was the affirmative vote?
The affirmative vote is that
so
the staff
no,
will go forth
no, no,
and...
So many no votes, don't you want to raise them? So
well, I counted one, two, three no majority. Votes, and there is a majority. All right? One, two, three, four.
A show of hands.
Five. You can have a show of hands. Okay? All those in favor? Okay. And we have six. All those in opposed? All right. Thank you very much. All right. The next item is the adoption of the 7000 series rail car design. Okay. A presentation by.
They could be checked by the chair.
Yes.
Good morning. My name is Dave Kubicek. I'm the Assistant General Manager over Rail Operations. Today we're here to provide a presentation on the 7K with regards to its design. Based on our previous meeting a couple of weeks ago, we wanted to go into this presentation. We wanted to make clear on our purpose that this is for the adoption of the 7000 series design for future rail car procurements. And again, this rolling stock will be utilized for the next 40 years. Beyond 2050. Some of the improvements that we're looking at incorporating with this new approach is to get away from the aluminum car frame and move towards a stainless steel car structure. We would also like to be able to add more exterior destination signage. Presently, right now, we really only have one per rail car on the side. With this design here, we would be able to incorporate an additional one onto the side. In turn, this would also allow us to improve our public address system, our speakers. Right now, we just really have one per rail car. We'd like to add two, so that way we can lower down, lower our volume output. It'll provide a better clarity. For example, the system that we work with right now is an analog-based system, and we would like to move towards a digital age, so that way we can get clarity and better communications to our customers. The other item that was on there was just on the intercar barrier. That was just an item that was, go back a slide, please. Those are basically the devices that are on the front of the rail car. Right now we use a chain device, which sometimes comes loose. It's very maintenance expensive to address. And then it also creates our staff that they have to get into the right of way to connect and disconnect these items. This design right in here would just let us be able to couple up and uncouple without putting our staff in danger in day-to-day operations. Next slide, please. Customer advantages. One of the things that we did do is make go through all of the committees, and one of the areas that we did work with very aggressively was with the RAC. Whenever we went back, we looked at this and really vetted things back and forth on what was the advantages, you know, for customers and what were they really looking toward. So these are some of the examples. We've got looking at an ergonomic seat, a stainless steel seat, so that way we can make it more comfortable. Resilient flooring, getting away from carpeted materials. Looking at more overhead and seat grab rail design. For example, we want to make sure that we have more opportunities for our passengers whenever they board our trains to enjoy the experience and feel secure in their environment. More vertical grab poles. What pretty much what that means is, with us eliminating some of the equipment underneath the seats, we can put more more poles throughout, so just is more grab points throughout the rail car. Some other areas of technology that we would like to introduce as well is an interactive route map. Say, for instance, you board at Metro Center. A lot of times we just go with traditional signage. It would be nice to have an LCD screen inside the rail car to basically show that we are at Metro Center, and they see a little bitty blip that's moving along in the direction of like Gallery Place or Chinatown, or vice versa throughout. This technology, we would be able to apply that on any alignment, any destination, you know, throughout. Security cameras, we would like to integrate that as well. We think that that's a big thing with our customer base continue to grow. Working with our police force and for incident review and monitoring and stuff would be as paramount at this stage as our ridership continues to increase. We are looking at eliminating operational cabs, so that way we have more capacity. It's truly just about customer service inside the cabs. We spoke about the equipment seat wells being eliminated. If you notice in our rail cars presently right now, we have four areas where we have these boxes that are underneath. And if any time that there's a mechanical or technical issue, we have to ask our customers to get out of the way, so that way our staff can swing these things out, swing these things back in. And it just creates more time. It's also unsafe. These things are very, very heavy. Whenever our operators have to pull them in and out, they do cause problems. The other advantage is from a cleaning perspective, without this being there, it makes it a lot easier for our cleaning staff to be able to just go through and sweep everything in one fell swoop instead of working around all these corners. The other component is LCD displays. Right below this route map, this would be the interactive route map. We're looking at incorporating LCD signage towards, we could put customer-related information inside the rail cars. Then the other component that we would be able to do is we would use this as a revenue generator as well, potentially, where we could sell advertisement inside the rail cars. This wouldn't be managed by a third party, per se, with the infrastructure and stuff. It would be something that we would directly control, and then we could populate inside our rail car at our discretion. Okay, again, on operational advantages, this will be a lighter rail car. We're going to be eliminating a lot of redundant equipment, a lot of hard wiring type of applications. With that comes reduction in weight, and we'll use less electricity. Improve train operator displays and controls. We've got some other slides that we'll talk through on that. The onboard diagnostics, that was broached in some of our other discussions. Is this car going to be more difficult for our operators to operate and for our maintainers to address in maintenance? As we work through this in the other portions of the slide, I think you'll see that this approach is more interactive. They have more written text, more descriptions at their fingertips versus the current platform that we work off of. The train network for communications, basically this means that this rail car is communicating all of its vital systems.
That's too great.
Could I, in the interest of time, I mean, we're 5 minutes away from our scheduled board meeting. Can I ask a couple of questions?
Mr. Graham?
I know this is not the Finance Committee, and I'm very anxious to discuss, and I have various questions about the design. But can you just remind us again, if we were to do all of what you, if we were to acquire these new cars, the 6000 series, what would be the price? And what, as compared to the price for the 7000 series, the same number? Because we're in a kind of a world economy collapse at the moment. And as much as I appreciate all of the enhancements, I just want to know right off the bat what we're paying for them.
Our current estimate to acquire cars based on the 7000 series design, and this is 748 vehicles in the proposed program, is about $2.1 billion, or about $2.8 million per car. If we pursued the 6000 series design, it would cost $2.1 to $2.2 billion, or about $75 million more for the same procurement. It's about a 3.5% increase for the 6000 series design over the 7000.
So you're saying the 6000 is more expensive to acquire?
Yes, that design would be for several reasons.
And it's the analog technology.
Yes.
Or my comparative.
It's the older technology. It's the industry as a whole is moving to different applications. If we continue to move forward with a 6000 series design, we are going to eliminate our competition, and we are going to have to do special buys, special inventory to sustain this over the life cycle.
So
Mr. Graham, go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate that clarification. Can you tell us the several reasons why the 7,000 is cheaper than the 6,000?
The two primary reasons are the elimination of the cabs of every other cab would save us approximately $38 to $40 million. It's consoles, the controllers, all the electronics that go into that. We would save at least $35 million from changes in technology, where we have currently about 100 watt wires that carry control signals from car to car throughout the train. We'll now utilize something similar to a Cat 5 cable, which will control all the devices in the train and it provides an additional reduction in operating costs, but it's at least going to save us $35 million in acquisition costs. There's other technological improvements in the speaker systems and the electronic control units that are in the train. Elimination of all the electrical mechanical devices and replacing them with solid state current technology devices. And it gets us about a $75 million savings.
Can you tell me about capacity?
What is the deadline to make a decision without disrupting the Dulles time schedule?
Well, at this time, we do have
64 cars, right?
The 64 cars, we have prior approval by the board to go ahead and move forward with the 64 car procurement. So we would like, we would release that in December. But what we, what we're looking at, the larger scale here is that we can move forward with a 64 rail car order, but it's going to be more expensive because, you know, we're not going to be able to take advantage of economy of scale. And the other, the large driver of this is that we would probably be forced to stay with a standard configuration. And even though this is the dullest rail car, at the end of the day, these rail cars are going to be running, you know, throughout the region. And so capital, it's going to cost us more on the initial investment. And then from an operating perspective, since it's going to be, you know, these cars would run throughout all of the districts and regions, there's going to be accelerated and increased maintenance expense over the life cycle of the car.
Well, let me just conclude by this, you know, because I'm before getting into this for us, I just wanted to get some basic clarity. But I'm concerned about, you know, if we do have questions, I have questions about the design of the car. And I'm trying to understand how, you know, we can have a thorough discussion about design, including capacity issues, without interfering either with our ability to take advantage of the economy of scale and the efficiencies and cost savings that we have in that, and also without disrupting, you know, the Dulles needs. But at the same time, I think we do need to have a discussion about the design of the cars, especially on the capacity issue, which you've already introduced. So I'm just trying to get a sense of what is the framework under which we can operate in this discussion. And if you're saying to us that we really have to take advantage of this 700, how many are we?
748.
748 car order, and we have to do it in December, and that we can't separate out the 64 cars, and we've got to move, then of course that's going to impact our ability to discuss the design more thoroughly, if you understand what I'm saying. And so I've got to understand what we're doing here.
Let me go back to it and pose it in a different way. This is discussion number four, I think, on design, and we've not actually had the financial discussion. It's coming to your committee next. And I think we've walked through here to just understand what we should move in going forward. If we were not procuring the 64 cars for Dulles, what would you be telling us here? Anything different?
If we were moving forward today, and
would you be telling? I'm going to cut your question short. Would you be telling us to purchase more 6,000 series cars?
We'd be forced to buy more 6,000 series rail cars.
Well, let me ask that question again, because let me just take your answer and go further.
Okay.
So you would be telling us to buy older model cars that would not meet tomorrow's technology.
No.
In the long term.
Okay.
Let me ask the question again.
All right.
If you were giving this presentation, would you be telling us to buy 6,000 or 7,000 or whatever the next generation of new cars for the future of Metro?
I would be recommending to buy the 7,000 series rail car.
So we would not want to buy 700 plus cars for the 600 plus cars for the expansion that we need in the 8-car train program with old model cars.
That is correct.
Couple things. One, let me ask you, what we're being asked to approve here, which is a design, what does that mean? Is this a 30% design? Is this a schematic design? In engineering terms, what is this?
This is an operational rail car. This is 100% where we would build this thing to run.
Okay, but you don't have blueprints worked up for this thing yet, do you?
No, not at this time.
Is some of the money that we would be ultimately spending is going forward, in fact, to have further design work?
No, this would really be a one-time expense over the 748 rail cars.
But you have to do it, is what I'm
yes.
saying. You haven't actually completed design. I mean, normally when we approve things at our policy level, and I know buildings more than I know stuff like this, but, you know, we say, you know, design of the building, but in fact, that's a certain percentage of design, and at least in construction, they have the concept of, you know, 30% design and all this. And there's actually more design work that has to be done. They come back and refinement, and it turns out some things have to be done a little differently. There's the okay. beginning and all that, because you don't know until you get into the thing. This is a highly complex piece of equipment, and I'm guessing there's a fair amount of that has to happen.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this is sort of a conceptual level of design.
It is a conceptual design. We are basing this off of what the industry is currently supporting, and you're looking at, you know, multi-units, higher technology throughout. All the rail car builders will build you know, consist sizes up to, you know, 8 cars, 5 cars, 6 cars throughout the world. And so we're, what we're talking about is supported by the industry.
So basically, there are a bunch of major components, kind of major features that you're fixing now as points. What it's going to be built to.
Yes.
Some of those, and some of the ones that are particularly important to you and important to cost and operation, all that, are the stuff that we all never see who ride, but are inside the car and are really important. You know, the electronics and
yes, sir.
The other kinds of engineering aspects of it. Some of them are the things that are real obvious to us, we focus a lot on. Like you got a layout of the inside that shows seating, for instance.
Yes, sir.
Okay. So, you know, some of the things that might still be of interest to a board member, for instance, might be of that nature, and they might not be entirely fixed because, number one, there might be changes based on whatever you discover as you go forward, but also some of them are things that are ultimately flexible. I mean, there's a range of flexibility with any kind of cars we've discovered. You know, the earliest cars, you could change certain things, but you couldn't change other things, and you learn from this, and the later cars, you have some more flexibility. So although you're showing a particular seating configuration here, that doesn't mean you couldn't come in and say, with this next order of 100 cars, we've changed this or that around a little bit. We're recommending we do this on the seating.
That is correct. We could make changes.
So one of the questions that a board member might be interested in is, what sort of things they're bought into when they approve this versus things that, you know, might still actually be, you know, up for discussion that could be altered when you really get around to ordering the next 100 cars or whatever.
Whenever we get down to the core technology, that would be something consistent. But say, for instance, let's use seating as an example. We use the seating configuration just as a proposal at this stage to try to populate as many of the traditional seating components and levels that we have at this time, where it's basically there, it's fixed against the wall and it hangs off. If somebody was to come back and say, well, we wanted all of the seats up against the wall in these certain areas and stuff, that is something that we would take direction under.
Could you change?
Yes.
Mr. Albert.
Chair, thank you.
Okay. And one just, I'm sorry, okay, but just one last thing. I understand how when you're removing the cabs, I mean, right now we have a six-car train, six-car consist.
Yes.
That's three pairs. And there's three pairs of cabs.
Yes.
So there's six cabs on that train,
yes.
Only one of which has been used.
That is correct.
And so what part of what you're doing here is knocking off half of those.
That is correct.
Our concept can only be three cabs, of which one is being used. So that's obvious. It's obvious that the savings is involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
It also liberates some space, does it not, in the car that will be occupied by passengers?
That is correct. And further in the slide, in the presentation, it'll show basically it's 100% all about passenger access.
So you've increased the capacity of the car.
Yes.
Which also goes to the question of cost differential, because although we compare the two, we say, well, this one might be slightly less expensive than doing a 6,000 series car. That loses the fact that if you said, if I got to move this number of passengers, I'd actually need more of the 6,000 rail cars than these were whole.
That is correct. We would need more rail cars versus this platform that we're proposing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Yes?
I apologize in advance if I ask a question that's been answered before, I guess, because I'm just coming to the board. What's the increased capacity that we get from moving from a 6,000 to a 7,000 series? Has that question been answered?
Yes, on average, whenever we look at this, we are looking to pick up, on average, about 40 more people per 8-car train than what we're capable of right now. It's very subjective on the crush loading, but the physical spaces and counting.
So you're saying it's about 3 to 4 extra passengers in a car? That we get from moving from the 600 series
like
to the
7.
Okay, great. So are there any other options out there besides the 7,000 series? I'm not an engineer. Have we explored? I just want to make sure that we've explored all other options to maximize capacity in the next series of cars that we introduce into the system. Have we, as a board, been convinced that we've done that?
At this time, we do have, you know, physical limitations. We have a dynamic envelope that the tunnels are only a certain size. So we can't build them any taller, and we cannot build them any wider, and we cannot build them any longer, realistically, because our stations is at maximum capacity. So where we could find the net savings.
But could you change the seating configuration?
Yes, that would be.
I'm most familiar with the New York City subway system.
Yes.
Where I've never had a seat in the decades I've lived there.
Yeah.
However, it's a very efficient system from my perspective. Okay. Have we looked at other transit systems to maybe import some other car options?
We have actually already tested bench seating concepts and lean-to concepts. At this stage, the direction that we received was to maximize the seating potential. So this is what this concept has, but it is very universal. It is very fluid. If we come back and we had direction to say, okay, based in this configuration, this car, we want the maximum number of seats. And then this car over here, we want to minimize the number of seating and have more standee area. That could be done and achieved. We would just need to have clarification on, you know, what is needed. But we're right now, what we're trying to do is whenever we start making the changes from, say, for instance, 68 seats to 32 seats, just using figurative numbers, I want to make sure that I have the infrastructure in place to support the maximum load of seats. And if we start taking seats out, then I have the structural integrity to support anything, because we're all that we're doing is reducing weight. But I just don't want us to be put in a position towards start out with just, say, for instance, a very limited number of seats. It's a lot easier to take them out than it is try to put them back in whenever you build the structure.
Okay, Mr.
I hope that answers your question.
Mr. Linton has a question.
What is the trade-off between, because I know in Toronto they have 8 doors, and we're going to 6 doors. What's the trade-off in terms of throughput, dwell times, versus capacity in 6 doors versus 8 doors?
Whenever we looked at that, we lost 25% to 30% of the seating inside the rail car. Now, we did gain some input, you know, as far as our dwell time, you know, for efficiencies boarding in and out. But whenever we did put that fourth door set in there, it definitely slashed the seating potential inside the rail car.
And how did you measure that? Both the what are you using? What are you using to evaluate the dwell time? And
well, right now we utilize
the model that you're using.
Yes. And then as far as the seating capacity, we pretty much just, on our drawing or our rendering, we pretty much just said, okay, well, let's just populate a doorway right here. We know that it is, it's 50 inches. Okay, based on this impact here, you have to compress all of these other areas, and you just have to start taking equipment out.
You mentioned that the industry is moving in this direction. What do you mean by the industry? What does that represent?
The industry is say, for instance, the major car builders. The Siemens, the Kinkashereos, the Alstoms, the Kawasakis, Rotem, Ansaldo Breda, Nippon Sharyo throughout. The industry there, then the subset of that is that all of the vendors and suppliers. So it's just not only the car builders that build these things, but it's the suppliers for brakes, propulsion, for doors. They are going with more standard platforms, because one of the big knocks that we have in the industry is that, you know, everybody builds a piecemeal type system. And so on our part, if we're able to go with a computerized high-end technology, more than likely we can get a service-proven door operator that has already been vetted and proven, versus having to buy something experimental with this old hard-wiring relay approach.
Has APTA come up with, has it been developed a rail car standard?
They are working on that very aggressively in the light rail world.
But not in the heavy rail?
On the heavy rail, that is being addressed. I am the vice chair of APTA's rolling stock committee, and that is one of our initiatives that we are working on, utilizing standardization of materials and equipment.
You mentioned one further question, Madam Chair. You mentioned the industry standard, but you talked about the vendors and the suppliers. This direction that the industry is going in. What is the direction that, on the demand side, what are the transit agencies going in terms of their new cars?
Okay.
Is the industry responding to this universal demand or description that the transit agencies are making in terms of, you know, what they want in terms of specs for their rail cars, or is the industry kind of leading us?
Actually, it's really going hand in hand, because you have some car builders now that are design, build, operate, maintain. You know, before they used to just build them and drop them off. Now they're seeing some of the shortcomings on what's taking place by them just building stuff and walking away from it. The other component on our part is the expectations, the duty cycle of what we're putting our equipment through is just continuing to push the envelope.
So are we in doing this in concert with some other agencies, or other agencies buying cars or asking for design similar to the one that you're supposed to?
Now, for example, we've been in conversation with Toronto. They're utilizing a multi-unit. We've spent a lot of time with New York. They're in the middle of buying a multi-unit. BART, we've been talking with them quite a bit because they're getting ready to buy 1,000, and they're moving towards
similar to design.
Yeah, similar. What we're looking at is that we know that our car body structures and stuff, because of the dynamic envelopes, are different. But say, for instance, the door system, the propulsion system, the things that really the communications. We're looking at really trying to standardize those things throughout.
So, but you're talking about the component parts. You're not talking about the steel in the car itself. You're
well, stainless steel is used in New York and Toronto.
That's the type of shell that you're talking about. I'm talking about the design of the car, the width, the length, the number of doors, the seating configuration. Is there any universal view in terms of that type of purchase? The subcomponents, yes. I can see some universal discussions about the new electronics, the subcomponents, the engines, all of that. But okay. I'm talking about the shell of the car.
Well, on the shell itself, I can't, at this stage, I could really say no. Because some of the infrastructure that is built has been in place for 80 years or 100 years or 50 years. For example, using BART as a model.
Right.
They run a wider gauge than the railroad. They have the widest rail car around.
Right.
And so it's very difficult for us to really compare our interior, sure. To theirs. But we can, so that's the distinction that we have to work against there.
No further questions.
All right, Mr. Kubitschek, we want to go through this one, and I think we want to go through it completely because we have come back, I think this is time number 4, on looking at the design. And seeing if we can arrive at the acceptance of a design. Would you move through the next 3, I guess 4 slides, remaining
yes.
slides quickly, so okay. that we can come up with what we will.
I'll be very quick on this. This is what is in our rail cars right now. This is what our operators and line supervisors and car maintenance have to maintain every day. It is basically hard wires, incandescent bulbs, push buttons with basically just labels underneath it. And whenever they run into problems and issues, and we have 1,500 to 1,800 people, this is the equipment and the tooling that they have to work with today. Next slide. This is what we're proposing. We're proposing LCD touchscreen type stuff that is very interactive. For example, you see an indication here of a rail car. Up here you see this little bitty bar. If the operator is sitting there working and something turned red, all that they have to do is touch this. It's very interactive. They know at that spot what's taking place inside that rail car. That would be the same thing for our maintenance. The other thing is that if rail cars are in green, that means that everything's okay. Yellow means that basically there's a warning, but we can continue to operate. Right now, what happens is that we have to go and we have to err on the side of caution, because our staff and what we have, they simply don't know. With this right in here, this will help us increase our efficiency on the alignment, keep things moving. It's at their fingertips, and we can scroll down. And our operators, like I said, they have this at their fingertips, as well as our maintenance people would be working in the same area. And if we were in another cab, if I was an operator running this rail car from the lead, and I was a maintainer, I could be at the back of this rail car troubleshooting this rail car while it was going.
Okay.
7,000 series on the maintenance side, longer useful life under the heavy sustained loading. What this means is this: the aluminum frames are cracking. We are going to be spending millions of dollars on these things to keep them sustained. They cannot handle the loading and the duty cycle that's taking place here. Stainless with a steel frame is going to provide us the necessary structure to be able to handle the loads that we're going to see here. Standardization of the fleet. you know, limiting of inventory streams, obsolescence, simplified maintenance training. This is a 10-year program that we're looking at, that we know that what we're going to be buying, we're going to have economy of scale to really take advantage of it, and we're not going to have piecemeal configuration. This is another huge one here, elimination of two major overhaul events. Right now, we have to do major overhauls every 4 to 5 years.
What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, say, for instance, I have to bring in a brake system. And based on its existing configuration of using older technology, older materials, I have to do it every 4 to 5 years just to keep this going.
So you have to rebuild that car?
That's correct.
And what would you see differently?
With this one right in here, we can go from a 4 to 5 year cycle to a 6 to 7 year cycle. We're using cutting edge material that is service proven out there in the industry. So with that, there's huge operating expenses that are placed in this that will basically be eliminated, and that we can apply this money and funding elsewhere. It also ensures that we have better availability of our rail cars. Because whenever you're putting these rail cars through these massive programs, you have assets that are sitting there idle, waiting to be worked on and addressed. With this extended out, that means that we have more availability of our rolling stock. The other component is eliminates of acid wash. We use an industrial aluminum here. It is very porous and it oxidizes. There's no way to clean it, or at least we haven't been able to find it, even with working with our environmental people, that they have not found a cleaning agent that can get rid of the scaling and the pitting. We are having to use acid. As the system increases, we're going to be using more acid-based materials, not to mention the residue that leaves on our wiring, not to mention the infrastructure like our vehicle washes and stuff that have to be maintained to handle acidic platform.
Let me just ask you to move forward on that.
Okay.
One, and just with the summary, are you telling us that the maintenance, there is a cost effectiveness in the maintenance of the...
Absolutely. With a stainless steel exterior, it would be just like your household appliance at home, where you can use a mild cleaner, mild soap, and you stay on top of it, we get away from this environmental mess.
And if you'd simply abbreviate this slide to tell us about the capacity on the cars.
Oh, okay. Okay, basically what we have here is this would be the lead-in. This is 64 seated areas. This would be, you know, kind of a traditional configuration. Now, we did have to, where we eliminated all of this equipment underneath all of these seats to make sure that we do not impact our customers. We're going to put this equipment down here in this lead-in. Most of the time, it's shut whenever the operator is in there anyhow, so it's dead space. So we really felt like that maximized the template of this respective area. Now, when you get down in here into this second car, if you notice, there is no operator's cab. It is all about capacity, what we can put in there, what we can move around. Now, one of the questions that we got is, say, for instance, in the yard from a maintenance perspective, how would we move this? Well, we'll put in like a little mini control panel, like a little mini operating deal. So whenever we're in the yard, we'll use this thing to move it around into their shops. We can go either direction without compromising safety or anything else. But whenever we're out there on the main line running, it's all about capacity for us.
Yes.
On the capacity issue, if we were to adopt the New York subway seat configuration with these cars, to what extent would our capacity, our car capacity be improved?
Right now, we don't have that answer. It could be very significant because New York has two configurations. One configuration has single seating on one side of the train. The other, they have removed all of the seats from certain trains during peak periods. So I don't know what that number is because we've never calculated that.
Well, can we get a better sense of what that would do for us before we decide this?
You can make that change even if you decide to move forward. We can move the seating configuration at any time during the process.
But I'd like to keep, as you pointed out, Ms. Hutchins, you know, this has been before us a number of times, but there's always a period of time when we, in between our considerations, when
you
we forget everything.
Every 2 weeks and once a month.
Pardon me?
Every 2 weeks and once a month. That's about out of motion.
No, but I mean, but there are a period of months between the number of times we've considered this over a period of time. And I just want to maintain this is kind of a coherent discussion. And so is it possible at the next meeting that we could have, you know, a better display of what our capacity options are? so that we can at least see it all as a unified discussion.
Maybe I can go back and restate that question, because I think you heard your answer. How many seats would we have on the first panel? And that is the configuration we see more or less today. Is that correct? What's the capacity on the first?
The first car right now here is 64, and then this one right down here is 68 of the traditional seats.
Okay.
But if I'm understanding correctly, when we say in New York style, we're talking about basically putting all of our seats against the wall facing in.
But the point I'm making is that as you remove the cab and all of that, you gain more seating there. You're saying that there is the capacity to change that seating, and let's go to the lower car, and change it around after we've made a decision.
Absolutely.
And put it against the wall.
Absolutely.
No seats on the other side of the wall if we choose.
Absolutely. Because
the number is going to be an increased number, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. But how? I'm simply requesting some specific sense of what would be the gain. I think Mr. Zimmerman made this point earlier in his discussion, that we have some time to deal with this issue. But I'd like to have a coherent discussion about this all together so that we can see just what the advantages are. I mean, it's clear, isn't it, Mr. Cato, that we're going to reach capacity even with the eight-car trains in the future?
At some point in the future, yes.
Do you have any sense of when that's going to happen?
I'm going to ask our planning department. We do have a
2025
plus or minus.
I
don't know what.
But we are making a $2 billion investment at this point, right? That's what we're discussing.
Yes. Investment of replacement cars as well as expansion vehicles.
So, I mean, it's prudent, even if we're that far away from our capacity. That's our core capacity number? 2025?
Yes.
And that's in line with the core capacity study we did?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman, and then Mr. Yule.
I just want to, Mr. Grant's raised very important points, and I agree. And I think what he's saying, I understand, is making this big investment, we have to make sure we've invested enough capacity as far out as possible. The key point, I think, it's important to understand, and I want to make sure that I'm clear on this. The board is not today being asked to pick a seating configuration. In fact, you're bringing us a design that has more flexibility in its internal seating configuration than the cars we have today. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So that the board, whether it's a month from now or 5 years from now, would under this design have the ability to say in any future purchase, we're going to change the seating this way or that way because we need more capacity here or whatever it is.
That is correct.
That flexibility would be there under this design.
Yes, that is the approach that we started from day one, was that we had the flexibility to come back and change it across the board. Realistically, since this is a cantilever design and we have sets out, that's the maximum amount of force. So if we draw seats up against the wall, that lessens the force. So we can...
It's complicated stuff to say.
Okay.
You'd be able to move it around more.
Absolutely. We can move it around.
And we have spent in the past some time looking at this, and we ran into all the inflexibilities of the current car. So that's obviously something that interests me. I do support Mr. Graham's request that we have more information developed so that the board can thoroughly examine this and make the decisions as we move forward. Thank you.
Okay. And your last,
with regards to the 7,000 series, are they, if we move in this direction, is this all going to be part of the 10-year plan?
Yes. Yeah, this is a global view, global plan across the board. We would like to refrain from buying 64 here, replacing the Roars of the 300, coming back to you on growth cars, midlife overhaul. This would be incorporated into the capital process, the prioritization. In every time that we would make a move, it would be there, and y'all would be involved because we would have to have y'all's concurrence. And for example, every step of the way.
Any other questions? And this is okay. I think we have two slides. One is a recommendation for action, and the next step.
Yes.
I move approval of the recommendation.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any discussion?
I think we have had a lot, but I do want to make this point for the record. I'd like the record to reflect this. that I'm supporting this on the basis of the comments that Mr. Zimmerman has made about our future flexibility. But I'm also supporting this on the basis of that the 7,000 car is going to be cheaper than the 6,000 car, as well as the other advantages that you have described, that it's going to be cheaper to buy these 7,000 series cars than it would be to go back to stay with the 6,000 series. And I just want to be absolutely clear that I'm assuming the accuracy of the information that's been provided.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Come back to it.
I'm supporting this, but I feel compelled to thank Mr. Kubitschek because he's come back over and over and over again on this. And it's clear that you've studied the industry and tried to, and even in the report it talks about the lessons, the decades of lessons learned, and you've tried to fix and address as many of the previous issues and problems that we've had. And I think, I do take you at, you all are the experts. It seems like that touchscreen interface will be a major improvement. Also, the flexibility of the seating, and as you said, the 6,000 costs more than the 7,000, but also the other cost benefits that have been highlighted in here. And I just think it's going to, it'll be an expenditure, but there'll be cost savings in the long run. And but I thank you for your perseverance in coming back and the diligence.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Hearing none. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
All those opposed? Hearing none. Thank you for the presentation. Thank you. There are no more items. We are adjourned and to Courtney. Thank you.
Meeting of finance.